Well, C.S. Lewis, or as you might not know, his full name is Clive Staples Lewis. And I'm sure this is a name that many of us have heard of, perhaps because in childhood you may have read the Narnia series. But what was the story behind this man, who is actually purported to be one of the most influential Christians of the 20th and perhaps even the 21st century? So today we're going to travel back a century to learn about this man who penned Narnia, as well as many other works that have influenced many people to turn to Christ. We begin in Belfast, in Ireland, where Clive Staples Lewis was born. He was a second son to Albert and Florence, both highly educated people. In fact, Albert was a solicitor, and Florence, his mother, was a mathematician. Their first son was Warren, and he was 3 years older. At the age of four, Clive Staples decided that he really didn't deserve that name. He insisted that his mother call him Jaxie, after a neighborhood dog that had recently been run over. And he was so determined in this that he refused to respond to any other name other than Jaxie. And so, from that day on, he was known as Jaxie, which became Jack, and all and sundry knew him as Jack. And so from now on, I'm going to also refer to him as Jack. Now, although the family grew up in Ireland and there was a lot of tension at that time, they were not Catholic, they were Protestant, although they were not particularly a religious family. But Jack already in his early years got a sense that Catholics were not to be trusted. Now, Warnie and Jack spent a wonderful childhood together. They actually both had a deformed thumb joint, which meant that woodwork and climbing and things like that were difficult. So they both spent a lot of time in the attic writing stories, imagining, creating worlds which would interact. In fact, Lewis had this whole elaborate world with talking animals, little mice in chainmail, fighting cats, and all sorts. His brother also had a world, but his was full of steam trains and machinery. And the two created full histories of these imaginary places and interacted, traded, and all sorts of things like that. These were idyllic days of solitude in a vast country house where they could roam the gardens and indulge in their imagination. The family soon moved to a house called Little Lee, and this represented Albert's increased status in the world. He wanted a larger house to reflect that. And Little Lee was a house full of corridors and hallways, and of course, stuffed with books. This was also a place of great joy for Jack as he explored and again indulged in his imagination. But even as a child, in this idyllic place and in the gardens and so on, Jack often longed for more. He termed this profound longing as joy with a capital J. He couldn't really describe it in these early years, but it was something he first glimpsed in his childhood, a moment of sheer happiness, exuberance. But it would fade and be gone. And he wanted to celebrate it, to capture this joy. It was like an unsatisfied desire, something that whenever he tried to grasp it would just fade out of his grip. And this became a central theme to his story and a theme that resounds throughout his life, his pursuit of this joy with a capital J. Now, one night when Jack was just 9 years old, he had terrible toothache and he cried out to his mother and called her to come. But she didn't come, and he called and called, and she still didn't come, and he didn't understand why. And then in the middle of the night, his father burst into the room in tears, saying that his mother was very, very sick with cancer. Well, Jack was terrified. He didn't even understand what was happening. But in the days following, there were strangers in and out of the house. There were hushed whispers. And in fact, his mother required surgery, which was actually done in the house, as was custom in those days. Jack and Warnie watched warily from a distance, and they felt that they were already losing their mother. Now, Jack remembered at this time that he'd been taught at church to pray. And so he remembered that if you offered prayers to God, then they would be granted. And so that's exactly what he did. He tried to pray in great earnest, with sheer willpower and determination, trying to ask God to heal his mother. Now, his view of God at this time was of like a magician of some sort, somebody who would come and perform the miracle that you've required and then disappear again until you required him again. Now, their mother was in considerable pain. The surgery didn't really help, and the disease was rampant through her body. So she soon passed away in 1908 on her husband's birthday. Now, Lewis had been so fervent in his prayer, but in fact, he wasn't as disappointed as you might expect. He kind of thought, well, his prayers hadn't worked, and he was used to things not working, so it didn't bother him. God was not to him a person. He was not a judge. He wasn't someone to love or to have any awe over. Meanwhile, Albert at this time was overcome with grief. The children too were struggling with grief, but in a very different way. For them, they had lost their mother a lot earlier, and they'd lost her to the pain, the morphine, the hushed whispers, the strange people in the house. And they had been very much distanced from their father during this time. But now the grief of losing Albert, losing Flora, was very difficult for him. And he became irrational. His temper flared. He had fits of rage. He spoke wildly and irrationally to his children and acted quite unjustly. And so Albert's grief lost him not only his wife, but also his two sons. Warnie and Jack ended up trying to rely on each other now to make life bearable. And Jack wrote, "With my mother's death, all settled happiness, all that was tranquil and reliable disappeared from my life. There was to be much fun, many pleasures, many stabs of joy, but no more the old security. It was sea and islands now. The great continent had sunk like Atlantis." Perhaps out of necessity, Albert packed off his youngest son to boarding school 2 weeks after his mother's death. Now, Jack was only 9 at this time, and he was to go to a prep school in England. Warnie and Jack were to be at this school together, and they travelled alone, actually, on steamship and a train to get to the school. Quite unthinkable in these days that you would send 2 boys aged 9 and 12 alone from Ireland to England by ship. But that's how it was in those days. And they loved it. They loved the freedom. They felt like grown-ups. Why Albert and Flora had picked this particular school is quite uncertain. It was certainly the stuff of nightmares. Jack actually had no idea what to expect at this boarding school. And Warnie never talked about school when he came home for the summer holidays. And Jack soon realized why. This school had only 20 pupils in total. The headmaster was a man, was quite a tyrant. He was nicknamed Oldie. The school itself was very run down and on the brink of closure. The dormitories had no curtains and were desperately cold. They had one bath a week and food was very much inadequate for growing boys. But the worst of it was this headmaster, who would hold the class in absolute terror with threats of violence. He had these fits of rage. Jack would describe the deathly silence in the classroom as they watched the headmaster take a running leap at a child in order to beat them. And this was simply because this particular child was from a lower class. His father was a dentist. And the boy tried to bear this in silence, but towards the end he would let out this gurgling cry of pain, which Jack found very difficult to forget. Jack had already been taught at home by his mother and a governess, and so his time here at this English prep school added nothing to his education. In fact, he quickly caught on from Warnie that you could get away with doing the same sums on your slate every day and no one would notice. You see, you would be beaten if you didn't do your sums, but no one actually checked what sums you were doing. So every day they just did the same sums over and over again, the endless, meaningless arithmetic characterized his time at this prep school. Now, the school folded 2 years later, and actually the principal was declared insane and died in an asylum. One good effect of this particular school was that Lewis attended a church, and he actually recalled being taught by people who actually seemed to believe what they were saying, and that impressed him. And at this point, he started actually trying to pray and read the Bible very dutifully, and he felt the gravity and severity of religion. In the between times during the school holidays, the boys' relationship with their father grew more and more distant. Albert was still struggling with his grief and was as volatile as ever, but then at other times he wanted his two boys really close to him. So in the holiday periods, Warnie and Jack were actually very relieved when their father went out for work for the day, and they knew that they had the house to themselves. Now, Lewis actually went to several schools over his childhood, and each had a particular impact on him as a person. And I've picked out a few of these things to share with us today. Now, it was very clear from the outset that Lewis was a very, very gifted child. He had an insatiable appetite for books and a very vivid imagination. In 1911, almost a teenager, Jack went to another boarding school. And he was there. There was a matron who sort of looked after the boarders. And she was a very motherly person. And because I think that Jack had lost his mother, he really connected to this matron. And she discussed a lot of spiritual matters as well. But she was interested in the occult, in Satanism. And this sparked a great interest in Lewis. And from this point, he started moving further and further away from Christianity. At this particular school as well, there was a younger headmaster who was very much a man of the world. He was interested in fashion and the theatre, in all the actors and actresses of the time. And he had an influence as well on Lewis. And actually, Lewis looks back at this time and sees that he learnt at this particular school to be quite a snob. By the time he was in his teens, he was going to be moving to Warnie's school, like a high school. This was a school called Malvern. Now, Warnie himself had a great experience at this high school, and he was very excited that Jack would be joining him shortly. But for Jack, it was yet another nightmare, but of a different kind. This time, it wasn't the teachers. In fact, he had excellent teachers at this school who really recognized his academic brilliance. They accelerated him and pushed him. But it was the students. You see, being an excellent scholar at Latin and classical Greek, and also terrible at sport, didn't really make you a favorite. There was also a distinct hierarchy in the students. The prefects could call on the younger students to make them do whatever they wanted. There was a lot of bullying, and Lewis particularly was picked on just because of the person he was. So there were certain prefects which made his life a misery. He was made to clean boots and do all sorts of dirty work. And he was often late to his own classes as a result of this. He missed out on his own study time. He couldn't keep up with his homework. And then there was the misery of compulsory games and sport, which he hated. He couldn't stand attending the rugby games and having to look happy and cheer for some random team. And he also describes this time as being extremely tiring. He felt dead tired all the time. There was never enough time for study. He couldn't keep up. The work was hard, and he was constantly targeted and bullied, and the stress of just not knowing what was around the next corner was enough to send anyone over the edge. But the other impact of this particular school was Lewis's growing sense of atheism. At this point, he very much agreed with the Greek philosopher Lucretius. Had God designed the world, it would not be a world so frail and faulty as we see. And he became quite pessimistic about the whole universe. And he lost his sense of joy. Well, Jack begged his father to take him out of this school, Malvern. It was really becoming too unbearable. But his father was not used to listening to his boys. He actually never really listened to them at all. But in a stroke of luck or a heavenly blessing, his father soon found out that Warnie was not doing as well at school as he had initially thought. In fact, Warnie was at risk of failing his exams to go into the military college. Well, this made Albert sit up and question the quality of the education at Malvern, and he was quite angry, and he pulled Warnie out of this school and sent him to a private tutor by the name of Professor Kirkpatrick. Now, Warnie actually did quite well under this private tutor and caught up academically, enough to be able to pass his final exams. And then Jack's petitions to leave Malvern were heard. His father actually thought to himself that perhaps, since Warnie had done so well under Professor Kirkpatrick, that perhaps Jack would also benefit as well. But, of course, he wasn't sure, and he called Jack to see him, and he said, "I'm thinking of sending you to this private tutor, a man by the name of Professor Kirkpatrick. But it will be quite dull for you. You'll be studying with this older couple, just on your own in the countryside. There will be no games, no sport. You will not have any opportunity to do that, nor will you have the company of other boys. You'll only have adult conversation. Are you sure you are ready for such a dull existence?" Well, Lewis tried very hard not to look too excited. He thought about it, and he said that perhaps he could manage. Well, Professor Kirkpatrick was the next huge influence on Jack. This man was close to a pure, logical entity as you could ever get. He would never let anyone get away with any sort of small talk, and Jack soon found this out. In fact, when Lewis got off the station, at the station, and met Professor Kirkpatrick for the very first time, he tried to make some sort of polite conversation, as he'd been taught as a good English schoolboy. And he remarked, quite politely, "Yes, I was quite surprised at the scenery of Surrey. It's a lot wilder than I expected." Kirkpatrick stopped, and he said, "Stop right there. On what grounds had you for not expecting the wildness of Surrey? And how are you defining wildness?" Well, Jack soon realised that this man was not making fun of him. He actually wanted to know. And it was soon very clear that Lewis really didn't know what he meant by wildness, and nor did he have any concept of the geography of Surrey and nor any idea of the flora. And so there was really nothing that led him to make that comment. "So don't you see," said Professor Kirkpatrick, "don't you see now that your comment was completely meaningless?" Well, some people would have found this a little too much to handle, but Lewis relished the challenge. To him, he said, it was like red beef and strong beer. He valued this purely rational way of thinking and talking, and he respected the professor, and he was soon trained to think in the same very rational, logical way. Now, Kirkpatrick was an atheist, and Lewis embraced this way of thinking. And during this period of his life, in his later teens, he did away with every scrap of religion left in his thinking. But this is one great irony of Lewis's life, because it was this training in rational thinking that enabled him to become one of the best Christian writers of our time. It was his highly rational approach that has helped many people grasp many spiritual truths. So, in essence, the Lord used this atheist to bless us all. The incredible rigor of the classical training that Lewis had under Kirk led to two things. Firstly, it led to the fact that Lewis was no longer the snob that he had been in his school years. He was really put in his place. Although he was brilliant, he was certainly not made to feel so. But the second thing was that he was brilliant, and that he passed his entrance exams into Oxford very well, even though at the time he believed he'd failed everything. And so he was invited to be a scholar at the University College in Oxford. He didn't really know it at the time, but Kirkpatrick had actually written a letter to Albert Lewis and telling him of his younger son's brilliance. And he wrote, "You may make a writer and a scholar of him, but you may not make of him anything else." And in fact, Jack knew that this was true. He knew that he was probably best as an academic. And that was a game that very few people won. It terrified him. In April, the train pulled into the Oxford station for the start of the academic year, and a wide-eyed Jack hopped out and was so excited to finally see this city of learning that he had had images of in his mind for years. He walked briskly out of the station, past all the shops, and he wondered why this city of Oxford that he knew was a city of towers and white spires, why it looked so drab and ordinary. He passed by some ordinary-looking flats and some mean little shops. They all just looked like a normal town. But he kept walking, thinking, just around the next corner, perhaps over the next hill. And it was not until he reached open country that he realized that he'd completely walked in the opposite direction. He turned around and started retracing his steps, and sure enough, just behind him, he saw the magnificent towers and the white spires of Oxford. It had been behind him the whole time. Later, he realized that this was an allegory for his whole life. This year was 1917, and Lewis already knew that it wouldn't be an ordinary one. The war was raging in Europe. Jack was 18, and he knew that he would soon be enlisted, and he would be starting his army training very soon. During his officer's training, he met another man by the name of Paddy Moore. They were roommates and became good friends. They each had only one surviving parent, and they vowed to each other that if one of them died in the war, that the other would care for the remaining parent. Now, Lewis did fight in World War I and was sent to the front lines in France, but he doesn't talk about it very much. In fact, he said that the war could have his body, but it couldn't have his mind. And in a way, he said, you expect war to be bad. You expect it to be horrific and traumatic. And that's perhaps makes it easier, because you had company in the horrors, unlike his school experiences, where he was actually expecting something different. But he does write something of the memories of the time. He talks about the icy water seeping into the boots he could never take off, the freezing cold, the mud, the barbed wire, marching asleep. He talks about men lying dead like half-crushed beetles, some even sitting up in their death, propped against some horrible roll of wire or wood. But he also remembers the good things. His particular battalion was made up of Oxford men, students like himself, but also farmers, barristers, a whole range of people. And generally, they looked after each other, and the conversation was excellent. During World War I, Jack was hit by a piece of shrapnel. The actual shell killed one of the other officers in his battalion. With these injuries, he was taken to an army hospital to recover. During this time, he wrote to his father, and although their relationship was not good at this time, he really wanted his father to come to him in the hospital. Actually, Jack felt he needed his father now more than ever. He was so alone and scared. He missed his family. He had seen so many horrors, and he just needed to see his father. But Albert was a strange man, who valued his work and his routine above everything. In fact, he valued it above his own children, and he never came to see his son. In fact, his father also never even came to see Jack off when he set sail to the front lines of France, even though it was very clear that he may not ever return. So Jack recuperated alone and was discharged. And during those times, he also found out that Paddy Moore, his good friend, had passed away. And so, true to his vow, he found Mrs. Moore, Paddy's mum, and also Paddy's younger sister, Maureen, and he decided that he would look after them for the rest of their lives. When Lewis returned to Oxford to resume his studies, it was to a very much a battered and grieving Britain. So many of his brilliant peers didn't return from the war. In fact, the porter greeted Lewis on that very first day, congratulating him for surviving. Lewis went to study philosophy, and he received two firsts, which was very unusual. But he couldn't get any work, so he continued on to study English, which he thought would enable him to have more opportunity for work. And he did a 2 or 3 year course in 1 year, and he received a first there too. But despite this huge amount of qualification, he couldn't get any work at the time. During these years, he was also influenced by some other people around him. A man who we would know as a famous poet, W.B. Yeats, was also in Oxford at the time. Now, Lewis didn't particularly view him like that. He called him a drunken but fairly eloquent Irishman. And this man, W.B. Yeats, was also interested in the occult and in Satanism, and often invited Lewis to come to his rooms and would practice seances and try to reach the dead, and they would talk often about spiritual matters. And again, Lewis felt this draw, this magnetism to look into the occult. He was fascinated by it, and he really saw it as a temptation. Around the same time, Lewis had moved in with Mrs. Moore and her daughter and was actually helping to support them. But he had meager funds at this time, and he still couldn't find any work. And he pretty much lived in poverty. He had a very frugal and simple lifestyle. And in fact, this kind of stayed with him for the rest of his life. He never really changed his lifestyle. This actually probably helped him relate to a lot more people. His time living with Mrs. Moore was actually very, very difficult. You know, although he called her mother and she did provide for him and support him, he was often required to do a lot of domestic work. And the people closest to Lewis felt that she was far too demanding on him, you know, always asking him to do all the household chores. But Lewis looks back on this time with Mrs. Moore and her daughter, and he realizes that this kept him really down to earth. It kept him humble. You know, no matter how much he was praised with accolades and seen to be a gifted conversationalist and excellent debater and incredible academic at Oxford, when he came home and was required to carry a sack of potatoes up the stairs or clean out a fireplace, he was always appropriately humbled. And he was also able to understand far more acutely the realities of daily life for the average person. Had he not had this experience, he would have lived with his head in the books, living through his imagination, and would really not be able to relate well to the average person. Now, part of his turning away from the occult and all that the temptation of that, part of that was came from an experience during this time with Mrs. Moore. Mrs. Moore's brother was a psychiatrist who was also very much interested in the occult. But he became very sick, and Lewis was required to care for him for about 2 weeks. And during this time, this man had these raving fits. He would cry out and scream that he was being dragged into hell. And this really shook Lewis to the core. Here was a man like him who was fascinated with the occult. And this is what it ended up as. Now, Lewis rationalized, of course, that this was just a mental health episode, but it shook him nonetheless, and he turned his back on these temptations to pursue the occult. In 1925, at the age of 27, Lewis was finally appointed a fellow at Magdalen College in Oxford. His father cried on receiving this news, and he actually fell to his knees and thanked God, an unusual move for Albert Lewis. Jack had a secure job. He would be an Oxford Don. Now, during these years, there was much lecturing and tutoring. He worked with individuals. He worked with whole classes and so on. But because he was looking at philosophy, he really had to think carefully about his own stance. And again, this idea of joy and trying to understand what this this was, this sense, this profound longing that was in him. Again, this came up. His first encounter was with a book by George MacDonald. Lewis had actually picked up this particular book at a station bookshop to while away the hours as he was waiting for a train. It was the book called Fantasties. Now, this was not an overtly Christian book by any means, and it was quite an allegorical book. But there was something in this book which sparked this sense of joy. He, in some ways, it was like he encountered for the first time holiness. And then he also read other books, which were not, again, overtly Christian, but their authors were Christian, books by G.K. Chesterton and the poetry of George Herbert and John Donne. In 1926, Lewis had a conversation with a really staunch atheist at Oxford, and this man offhandedly remarked, "Rum thing, all that stuff about a dying God. It almost looks like it had happened." Now, this man was known to Lewis as a very hard-boiled atheist, if you like, but even he had to admit the historicity of the Gospels. Well, this really bothered Lewis, because what did it say about his position? He couldn't sweep Jesus aside. Because this was one thing about C.S. Lewis. He had integrity. He had learned under Kirkpatrick to think rationally, to think critically, and to think consistently. He had to recognize bias, and he needed to accept the truth even when he realized he didn't like it. If you'd asked Lewis at this point about his stance, he would have said to you that he was a materialist. He was someone who only believed in the material world, things you could see. He would say that all religions were just mythologies made by humans for humans. But the other thing he was thinking was that it really wasn't safe being an atheist. God, for whom Jack referred to him as the enemy, God was on the move. And from the literary greats writing from a Christian worldview, to open Bibles that he passed by in corridors, to newfound friends who he discovered later were actually Christians or were seeking faith themselves, Lewis felt that he was being attacked from all sides. And then in those quiet moments when he had time to reflect, all he felt was the steady approach of God. And no matter how hard he tried, he could not ignore the God of the universe. And he recognized in himself that he didn't want God. He called him the great interferer. He hated the idea that God would take control of his life. He wanted to be in control. And then, one day, in 1929, Lewis took a bus home. Nothing unusual there. It was the Oxford City bus. But on this bus trip, he realized that it was no good. He had to stop shutting God out. He knew that he had been holding that door shut with sheer will, determined not to allow God to come close. And suddenly he felt that he needed to stop. "I needed to open, unbuckle, to loosen the rein," he wrote. He felt no compulsion to do this and also no sense of reward. But he decided to be open with the truth and not hold back. It was a very simple decision on this bus. He decided that God was God. After this moment, Jack, he described God's very clear approach on his life. He actually still believed at this point that God was his adversary, and he still held on very tightly to this idea that he wanted some aspect of his life that he could control. But then finally, one night in his rooms, he gave in. And this is what he wrote. "I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. I did not then see what is now the most shining and obvious thing. The divine humility, which will accept a convert even on such terms." Even the prodigal son came back on his own two feet. Jack felt like he was coming in, kicking, screaming, being dragged, struggling, eyes darting about, looking for some sort of chance to escape. Now, at this point, it is important for us to note that C.S. Lewis was not saved. He had acknowledged God, and he could no longer call himself an atheist. God was God. But what about Jesus Christ? Now, 2 years later, one fine autumn night, Jack had invited his good Oxford friends over for a meal, and they were now sitting in his rooms, and after that they went for a long walk around the grounds near the college. And if we were there, we may have recognized one of these friends. It was the professor of English language, a master of philology, a man by the name of J.R.R. Tolkien. The other was Hugo Dyson, another English academic at Oxford. They had been discussing mythology all night, and this had soon evolved into discussions about the gospel, and then, of course, a discussion about Jesus. Tolkien had pointed out that, yes, you could see some similarities with myth, but the key difference was that this is true. And Tolkien also pointed out that Lewis, in his responses and reactions, was not at all consistent. It was very clear to Tolkien that Lewis was prejudiced against Christianity. And Lewis really had to acknowledge that his good friend was right. The man walked up and down this Addison's Walk into the early hours. And this was a very, very significant turning point for Lewis. Now, Jack had an excellent sense of humour. And I think we can say that he got it from God. This time, God chose a different form of transport to meet Jack on, and it was a far more uncomfortable one. A week after this conversation, Mrs. Moore and her daughter, they wanted to go to the zoo, and Warnie, who was back from military service and living with them, they were all going to go together. But the day was a bit foggy and the women were fussing, and they'd sort of almost given up on the idea of going to the zoo. But then they reached a compromise. The women would take the car, Warnie would drive the motorcycle, and Jack would be in the sidecar of the motorcycle. Oh, this was a bit of a sacrifice for Jack. He didn't really like Warnie's driving, for one, and the other thing, it was rather uncomfortable to be squashed into the sidecar of a motorcycle. But he agreed nonetheless. And it was in this moment, squashed into the sidecar of a motorcycle, watching the English scenery zip by, that God came to Lewis again. And as he sat there, he realized that he really needed to make a decision about Jesus Christ. He thought through the late night conversation. He thought through all the different influences that had been accumulating in his life over the past 2 years. And by the time they'd reached the zoo, Jack believed that Jesus was the Son of God, and he had committed his life to him. It was not an emotional time, but he was very clear. When he left home, he was a theist. By the time he arrived at the zoo, he believed in Christ. He was a Christian. He wrote to his good childhood friend, Arthur Greaves, "I have gone from believing in God to believing in Christ." And what of that joy, that profound longing that had been a huge theme in his life since early childhood? Well, he simply stopped pursuing it. As he explained, when you're lost in the woods, the appearance of a sign a little way ahead is an immense relief, and everyone gathers around to gaze at it. But when you know you're heading in the right direction, then you can happily pass by all the signs. You don't stop and gaze in wonder, for after all, you know where you're headed. You know you're on the right path. And for sure, Lewis did know that he was on the right path, and he also knew that he was heading towards the source of all joy. And so began his Christian walk. Lewis was now in his early 30s, and immediately he began writing Christian texts. The first was an allegory of his own conversion, a book he called The Pilgrim's Regress. And many works followed this. He wrote a science fiction trilogy. He wrote The Problem of Pain, Mere Christianity, Screwtape Letters, The Abolition of Man, Miracles, The Four Loves, Surprised by Joy, Grief Observed. All of these books came flowing from his pen. And with all of this, he decided that he wanted to start an informal gathering with some other writers, other friends who were also writing things at the same time. Of course, it would be a bit of a social time, but it would also be an opportunity of sharpening each other to really, give good critique. Tolkien was a central member of this group, which was called the Inklings, and there were many other famous names over many years. It was quite intimidating to read your new chapter to this particular group of great minds. Tolkien, for example, was not a fan of Narnia. It was a disorderly place, he thought. How could you have dwarves and fauns and talking beavers all in the one place? But on the other hand, Lewis recognized the brilliance of the Hobbit stories, as they were called back then. And he really encouraged Tolkien to continue writing. He said, "It's like lightning from a clear sky." And later, Tolkien actually credits Lewis for getting him through The Lord of the Rings, noting that were it not for his strong encouragement, he would have given up on several occasions. But then, Hitler rose to power. And this generation of men, who had already endured one world war, was thrown into yet another. Now, during these war years, Lewis's work changed completely. In fact, his work diminished. Many students and teachers had left Oxford to join the war effort. He too joined the Home Guard. But in addition, he was also asked to address the RAF, these pilots who were so crucial at this particular point in the war. Now, traveling the country during this time was difficult and dangerous, but Lewis was determined to do it. Here were Britain's best and brightest, young men who were terrified. These pilots, they lived an average of 13 missions, and they knew the grim reality that every day could be your last. So Lewis went to address them, and he quickly learned that he needed to speak their language. All of those years of lecturing and tutoring at Oxford had really not equipped him to speak to young men of all walks of life and from all different classes. And the first time he did it, it went terribly. But he was a quick learner, and he trained himself to change his style of language, to think very carefully about the illustrations he used, to really get amongst these people, to learn how they thought and what they actually believed. Little did he know that this was preparation for his next task. By this time, Lewis's name was becoming very well known. His book, The Problem of Pain, had attracted the attention of many people, including a certain Reverend Welch from the Religious Broadcasting Department of the BBC. They decided to invite Lewis to give a series of addresses on the radio. Now, this was a really crucial time in the war. This was during the Battle of Britain in 1941. And it was during this time that every night the British public were being bombed by the Germans. In fact, bombs were falling. One bomb had actually fallen during a BBC live broadcast. Lewis had no experience on the radio, but he agreed. And he had no idea how successful these little 15-minute talks would become. He was going to be recorded on the Home Service channel. He was going to be broadcast to the front lines, to soldiers, but also into homes in pubs across the country. And what a different world it was back then. You know, it's hard for us to imagine that a mainstream service like the BBC would approach someone like Lewis and ask him to speak on Christianity and the meaning of life. But that's what Britain needed at that time, and that's exactly what they did. Now, Lewis had to learn very quickly, and he adapted his speaking style very well for the radio. He had to ensure also that his writing was not just aimed for one particular Christian denomination. He wanted to ensure that he was pointing everyone to Christ. And he made it very clear that he was no theologian and was just an ordinary believer speaking out to you and someone who'd recently discovered Christ. Now, these broadcasts were soon published into little volumes. And then, finally, they were combined and put together in a volume which Lewis called Mere Christianity. Now, after the war, Jack was very, very well known. He became famous. And this was not only because of these broadcast talks, which were also now being published, but for another book that he had written during these war years. Screwtape Letters had hit the shelves. Now, this was a unique book. There was nothing like this. And in fact, I would say there probably still isn't anything really like Screwtape Letters. It's a book, a collection of fictitious letters from one devil to another. A senior devil giving advice to a junior devil on how to stop a man from becoming a Christian. And then, if unfortunately he does become a Christian, how to stop him from developing and growing in his relationship with God. Lewis actually had the whole idea of this book one Sunday morning during a sermon. Evidently, his mind was wandering. This book made Lewis very famous in America, and then also his other books took off there as a result. And so suddenly Lewis found himself famous, and he really struggled with this. It just didn't feel right to him. He soon set up a trust fund, and he put all the royalties for these books into that fund, and he was a very generous man, and he gave away a lot of money to widows and families who were suffering after the war. We skip ahead a few years, and it's now 1952. Jack never married. He's now in his 50s. He was a comfortable bachelor living at home in a house known as the Kilns. This was a house that Mrs. Moore, Warney, and himself, they'd pulled together and they'd bought this particular house. And now it was just he and his brother living there. Mrs. Moore had passed away and Maureen, her daughter, had since married. And here he was receiving many letters, and he received one from an American Jewish lady by the name of Joy Davidman. And in this particular letter, she raised objections to some of his writing, and he answered it very thoroughly. Joy Davidman, who was in America and received Lewis's reply, and was blown away by how ruthlessly he had removed all her grounds for argument. Joy herself has her own story. To be brief, she was a Jew but brought up an atheist. She herself was an academic, a writer. And she was also a bit of an activist, part of the Communist Party in the early days and so on. She married, but her marriage was always difficult. And she too was seeking meaning for life. She had read many of Lewis's works, and they helped her immensely. And eventually, she turned to Christ and became a Christian. Her marriage was falling apart. In fact, her husband had been unfaithful repeatedly. He was an alcoholic. He was also very violent. And she had two young boys. It was no longer safe for her to remain at home. Her health was suffering. And she decided to travel to London to be with her friends. She was also writing a book and doing research at the time. So when she arrived in London, she also sent a message to Lewis to see if he would meet with her to continue conversing. And he did. And during this time, her stay in London, she also received a message from her husband wanting a divorce. He had been unfaithful again and he wanted to end the marriage. So Joy Davidman applied to stay in England. She met Lewis several more times and they got on really well. They were both very similar minds and everything seemed to be falling into place. But just at the last minute, her visa was rejected because they'd found out that she had previously been part of the Communist Party in America. And so Joy was quite stuck. You know, her boys didn't want to go back to America to be with their abusive father, but it looked like they would have to do so. Now, during all of this period, Joy and Jack had become very close friends. In fact, he had really supported them through his trust fund. He'd even paid for the boys' education. And Jack was exceedingly generous like this. And although it seems unusual to us, whenever he saw a need, he would just meet it. He had no concept or thought about money except to give it away. But there was another very unusual and generous thing he decided to do. He said to Joy that there was one way of enabling her to stay in the country. And he offered to marry her. But he also recognized that he was 14 years older and she probably should marry a younger person. He also didn't think that she would really want to marry him. And so he said, we'll do it as a legal, sort of a civil ceremony, and then you can annul it afterwards if you want. Well, this was not Lewis's wisest decision, and it certainly demonstrated that he had the wrong view of marriage. But also at this time, Jack had no concept of how much he really did love Joy, and nor did he know how much she loved him. The two were married in 1956 in a civil ceremony, and Joy soon was able to stay in England with her two boys. Now, the love between Jack and Joy blossomed after their marriage. And the boys, you know, it's hard to imagine, but these boys had read the Narnia series and loved the Narnia series. And then imagine their absolute shock and delight that their stepfather was actually going to be was the author of the Narnia series that they'd read and loved. And that was their delight. They loved Lewis and they loved spending time with him. In fact, Douglas, the younger of the sons, we can thank him for compiling a lot of Lewis's work after his death. Now, one day, Joy fell suddenly. It was like her leg buckled underneath her. And examination revealed that her thigh bone had literally crumbled in one part. And further examination discovered cancer through her whole body, through her bones. Now, Jack was absolutely beside himself with grief when he found out this news. And Joy's decline was very quick, and she was soon bedridden. And it was this crisis that made Jack realize how much he truly loved her. And he recognized that he wanted to marry her properly now. He wanted to marry her under God. He called up a reverend friend of his to come to the hospital to perform the ceremony. And there were just a few friends in the hospital room. The two of them were married. And Jack promised, he vowed, to have and to hold in sickness and in health. And there in the hospital room as well, they'd also prayed fervently for Joy's healing and recovery. But the doctors had no hope, and they sent her home from the hospital so she could die in peace at home. Now, Lewis did everything to make her comfortable at the Kilns, and he continued to support the boys so that she wouldn't need to worry. But strangely, Joy started to improve. Instead of slipping into unconsciousness like it was predicted, she actually started to grow stronger. Soon she was getting up. She was walking with a frame and a stick. She was soon pottering around the garden. And then she was making suggestions on home improvements, things that Jack and Warnie should have done years ago. And then she was starting to cook better meals for the whole household. This was nothing short of a miracle, and Jack recognized it as such. The doctors did more scans and were shocked to find that far from deteriorating further, her bones seemed to have become stronger. Jack would have Joy for a little bit longer, it would seem. In fact, Jack's health at this point was not great. He had kidney difficulties and osteoporosis, and he actually believed that he'd borne the burden with his wife. It was like he became weaker, she became stronger. So this frail couple loved and appreciated every hour they had together. They knew just how temporary life was, and they thanked the Lord for allowing them this extra time. And soon the cancer did return, and when it did, Joy passed away very quickly. And this really shook Lewis. Yet again, he experienced profound grief. But this time, he had faith, and his faith remained strong. He wrote, "We can ignore even pleasure, but pain insists upon being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world." Soon after Joy's passing, Lewis wrote a book called A Grief Observed, a very personal account of his own journey through grief to acceptance. And at the end of this book, he writes that she smiled in that moment of passing, and he realized that that smile was looking on into eternity, not back to earth, but on into eternity, towards the source and fountain of life. When Joy died in 1960, they'd only been married for 4 years. And Lewis then returned to his former routine. It was now just him and Warney yet again. Their father had also died years ago, and Joy's two boys were now grown as well. So Lewis continued his work, he continued writing, he answered letters, which were now pouring in by the thousands. He really tried to answer them all, with the help of Warney and a secretary. But during this last decade as well, he was a prolific writer. It was during this last decade that he wrote the Narnia books, inspired, yes, by his stepsons and also by children who stayed in the house during World War II. But actually, the images that he had of Narnia had been with him for a very long time. It's just he didn't know what to do with them. He talks about having this image of a fawn carrying parcels, tottering to the snow and pausing under a lampstand. And then he talks about how Aslan just bounded in. During this time, he met with friends. He had many conversations. He never turned down a lunch meeting. But also, his health was becoming worse and worse. He was now in his 60s, and soon he was unable to mount the stairs of his own house because of his osteoporosis. Warney was the one that cared for him during this time. And then, one evening, on November in 1963, Lewis said quietly to Warney, "I've done all I wanted to do. I'm ready to go." And 2 days later, the day began just as usual. The brothers exchanged a few words, but Lewis was quite tired. He went to answer more letters. They had tea. And then at 5:30 in the evening, Warney heard a crash, and he went to see Jack lifeless on the floor. Jack, his beloved little brother, was now with the Lord. With all of Jack's publications and all his writing, he'd been approached during his life by a solicitor friend who wanted to discuss with him what he wanted to do with the royalties of all these books after his death. "After my death?" Lewis had laughed. "You know, after 5 years, no one will be reading anything I've written." Well, C.S. Lewis was many things, but he was not a prophet. The Narnia series alone has sold over 100 million copies around the world. And his works are still so popular today and have helped to clarify the basic principles of the Christian faith in a very simple and rational way, with a bit of imagination and humour, a rare combination. Lewis was by no means perfect. He struggled with fame. At times he had questionable views. He knew his limitations. And he was also very teachable. He himself wrote, "I have no claim to speak as an expert and merely put forward the reflections which have arisen from my own mind and have seemed to me, perhaps wrongly, to be helpful. They are all submitted to the correction of wiser heads." C.S. Lewis was yet another of God's servants, who used his clear gifts with language, with speaking, with writing for the kingdom and for the glory of God. And he certainly spoke to his generation. Now, considering his fame, the news of his death and his funeral were marked with very, very little ceremony. And in fact, his passing was quite eclipsed by the assassination of JFK, which occurred on the very same day. But this, of course, is of no consequence in the light of eternity. And we can imagine now Lewis basking in the fulfillment of all joy, a joy that had led him to the cross and to see Jesus as Lord. Hope you can permit me a little liberty with the very ending of the Chronicles of Narnia. And for us, this is the end of all the stories. But for him, it was only the beginning of the real story. All his life in this world and all his adventures had only been the cover and the title page. Now, at last, he was beginning chapter 1 of the great story which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before.